the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
In this April 2015 edition of Education Now, I welcome Philip Cantor, Master in Education, teacher at Chicago Public Schools and Science Department Chairperson at North Grant High School, to discuss the recent mayoral election in Chicago. Philip has been a guest several times over the past 3 years. Mayor Rahm Emanuel won re-election in a hard-fought runoff against Jesus Chuy Garcia. Emanuel defeated Garcia with a margin of around 55% to Garcia's 44%. Emanuel raised $23 million for the campaign, three times Garcia's $6 million. Garcia is the son of Mexican immigrants, and his rise to such prominence shocked the nation's political establishment by forcing Emanuel into the runoff earlier this year. Emanuel has faced public dissatisfaction over his closing of 50 schools in mostly African-American neighborhoods, his handling of a 2012 teacher strike, and the city's high murder rate and levels of gun violence. Jesus Chuy Garcia was asked by Karen Lewis, the Chicago union leader, who had been considering a bid to unseat Mayor Rahm Emanuel, to run for the office. She did not run, as she continues treatment after surgery for cancer. Miss Lewis, a longtime high school chemistry teacher, gained national attention for leading Chicago public school teachers on a strike in 2012 and later criticizing Mr. Emanuel for supporting the closing of dozens of schools. So hello, Philip. It is such a pleasure to have you back again.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, that was a kind of a long introduction, but I felt that our listeners would need to know that all of that background. And so let's start with some questions. What does the Chicago mayoral race mean for the city and for public education in general?
So I think the Chicago mayor's race here, it's part of a turning point that's been happening over the last couple of years. What we saw was an incumbent mayor with tens of millions of dollars, I think, overall between the initial race and his political action committee and this runoff, he raised over $30 million. He had that much in his war chest. And even with that, a candidate who came in very late in the process, with only about 6 months before the election, due to Karen Lewis's illness, was able to, A, push him into a historic runoff. We have never had a runoff in Chicago, meaning that Rahm Emanuel did not get more than 50% of the vote in the initial election, which caused this runoff election. That's never happened in Chicago. The law that put the runoff into place was put in about 25 years ago, and there's never been one before. So this is historic in that way. And the fact that Chuy Garcia was able to get very close to unseating Rahm Emanuel with such a short period of time and such a tiny amount of money relative to Emanuel is pretty impressive. And I think that speaks to sort of a grassroots movement that's been going on in the last couple of years. And that grassroots movement, I believe, is really part of something that's going on across the country in terms of people's dissatisfaction with education, public education systems as they're being reformed now, sort of the corporate education reform movement. So it's people being upset about standardized test-based accountability systems, people being upset with the uneven distribution of resources in schools, people being very sick and tired of the racial disparities in schools and how they're funded and how, the kinds of resources that schools get. So I think this election was not just about Rahm Emanuel, but also very much about education policy, standardized tests, racial disparities, et cetera.
Yes. I read after the election that which kind of surprised me, that Emanuel really was elected with a black vote.
Yeah, that was truly upsetting and a little bit surprising to me and to many others here in Chicago. But if you look at, you know, a lot of that comes down, I think, to the local history of Chicago politics and sort of the racial component to that, where people do tend to vote in racial blocks here in Chicago. Our hope was that Chuy Garcia could have sort of revived a coalition that existed back in the 80s when we elected the first, well, he was really the second black mayor, but the first elected black mayor of Chicago, Harold Washington, who was very progressive and was put into office through a coalition of African Americans, Latinos, and progressive whites. That didn't happen in this election, and that's partly due to, I think, the huge funding disparity that was going on. So where Rahm was blanketing, you couldn't turn on a television or a radio or go to a newspaper's website without seeing Rahm Emanuel ads. So it was just blanketing the city. We also had incredibly low voter turnout. Back in the 80s, about 85% of Chicagoan registered voters voted in Chicago. In this election, only about 40% voted. So there was a lot of apathy, a lot of the feeling that, you know, it sort of doesn't matter who the mayor is because they're all corrupt, which is not an accurate portrayal of Chuy Garcia, but that's kind of the kind of thing I heard. Also, because of the runoff election, there was a lot of confusion. I talked to some people when I was knocking on doors for Chuy who thought they didn't have to vote again in the runoff because they voted in the original election. They thought their vote would count again. So there was a lot of confusion as well.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think Chuy did a good enough job in the black community talking about what he needed to do for them specifically, even though his education plan would have really benefited them, his positions on education, his positions on economic development would really have benefited them much more than Rahm Emanuel's. I don't think he got that message out effectively. There's also a lot of, there's still some sort of racial competition here in Chicago where, you know, some African-American voters are very weary of somebody who's Mexican feeling like, oh, he'll just shift resources to the Mexican community. And the same is true the other way around.
Yeah.
That has a lot to do with sort of the local politics going on here, more so than, you know, the real interests, I think, of the people involved.
Yes, well, it's amazing that even given that it was such a close margin, I mean, 55% to 44%, that's really close. And the other, I feel like Garcia did a spectacular job really showing that there was a lot of dissatisfaction with Rahm Emanuel. I was disappointed that President Obama came out for Rahm, and I feel like that probably encouraged a lot of the black community not to vote for Garcia. But I feel like something exciting is happening. And
yeah,
that this election
yeah
is just a, kind of an indicator of that.
Yeah, and, you know, really our candidate who we hoped to run was Karen Lewis, and I think had Karen run, I think she could have beat Rahm. She had tremendous support in the black community, as well as among people who have school-aged children. I was looking at the some of the stats from the election, and actually anybody who had a child of school age, anybody below the age of 18 in the home, those families went 60 to 70% toward Garcia. Younger people went 60 to 70% toward Garcia. The only demographics that went more toward Rahm were people above 45 years old, people with no children in the household, people with no union members in the household, et cetera. So this really was about who got out to vote, which was your typical sort of older voters, as opposed to, you know, the real issues in the campaign. So,
yeah.
You know, it was up to us to get those voters out, and we tried our darndest, but, you know, we fell short of that. But I think this is a much bigger fight than, you know, Chuy Garcia. He would have been a much better mayor than Rahm, but, you know, even Chuy wasn't completely sort of in alignment with everything that I would hope for in a mayor. Like, you know, he didn't agree 100% with what Karen Lewis would have wanted to do in many ways. He was much more sort of middle of the road, trying to sort of, you know, be sort of more attractive to the middle as opposed to being more aggressive in his policies. And, you know, he has been in politics for 30 years, and that's kind of what you have to do if you're a lifelong politician. So
right.
I was really hoping for Karen to run or somebody more a little bit more radical. But I think the movement itself is going to continue. I mean, that's what I'm seeing, and that's the importance here, is that people feel like they have some power, they have some agency, and we're pushing forward. And there were many smaller victories. We won several aldermanic races. Our city council is made up of 50 aldermen, and the progressives won several of those races. So we'll have a few more aldermen to fight against Rahm and to stand up to him, so the city council won't just be a rubber stamp, which is what it's been in the past.
Yes, so he's going to, I feel like the progressives really made a huge dent in his machine, and Rahm Emanuel's machine, and that gives me great hope that there's changes in Chicago and the rest of the country, as you said earlier. Now, the Chicago Teachers Union's contract is up this June. Will there be another strike, Philip?
Boy, I hope not. You know, I don't think anybody really wants a strike, but it's going to be an interesting fight. You know, the union has already, we've come out with some of our main points that we're going to be pushing for in these negotiations. We're pushing for class size limits that are actually enforceable. Currently, class size limits are seen more as a suggestion than a requirement. So in some schools and the schools that have less funding, some of the class sizes are, you know, 32, 34, up to 40 children sometimes in classes. And that's it's really hard to give kids.
No, that's just terrible.
You know, we're actually calling for very small class sizes for pre-K through second grade, class sizes of about 18. And then, you know, moving up to, you know, 25 to 28 maximum throughout the system, which is not rocket science, and it's not anything radical. That's what, you know, people in private schools have. That's what people in wealthier suburbs have and in many school districts. So we're pushing for that. We're pushing for having the necessary clinicians and wraparound services in schools, things like school counselors who actually have time to do counseling. Currently, many school counselors, many elementary schools have only one counselor, even if they have, you know, 800 students or 1,000 students. That one counselor also has to be the special education case manager, so they're arranging all the IEP meetings and things like that. they really have no time to actually work with students one-on-one or in small groups and do counseling. We think every school should have a nurse. We think every school should have... most schools don't have a full-time nurse. In fact, there's only about 6 nurses in the entire district who spend their day at one school. Most of them move around day to day from one school to the others. The schools get a nurse, you know, only a couple days a week, and that's ridiculous. A diabetic child doesn't only have their diabetes 2 days a week. You know, it's sort of insane the way we're doing things here. About half of our schools don't have a librarian.
Oh dear!
Many elementary schools don't have anybody. They don't actually have teachers or trained professionals supervising students during recess and things like that. So I've heard some pretty negative stories about these sort of part-time people with no training they hire to manage recess, whereas, you know, play is an important part of learning, and we should have people supervising recess who know what they're doing. You know, many schools have lost their art teachers or music teachers. It's just, so we're pushing for that, fully staffed schools, right?
These are the issues. What you're talking about now are the issues that the Chicago Teachers Union will be fighting for.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, we hope that we can come to agreement with the district about this stuff. Like, I don't think, you know, Rahm Emanuel's kids go to a very, very nice, very well-run private school, and we're really not asking for anything that, you know, his children don't have. You know, his kid's school actually has 2 libraries with librarians. You know, many CPS schools don't have a library or a librarian. You know, so we don't think that these are difficult issues in terms of people agreeing on them. Part of the issue is going to be how to pay for these things. And the union actually has some suggestions about that as well. The city has gotten into some pretty toxic financial instruments over the last few years. And, you know, we believe that we really should be suing the banks to get back some of the money, which basically, you know, our Board of Education has lost for the district hundreds of millions of dollars, was lost through these toxic interest rate swaps and things like that. And if we pull out of these, we would have to pay hundreds of millions in fees to get out of these toxic relationships with the banks. But the union believes there's some legal recourse in there, and we could theoretically sue, and we would have a good case to get out from under some of these insane fees at the banks. And Rahm Emanuel hasn't made any effort to even try these things, and we're really pushing for him to do that. It's not okay to say, well, sorry, we can't afford to have a counselor at your school or a nurse at your school or a librarian or an art teacher because we're broke, but I'm not going to do anything to try to get the money back that we lost with these bad financial decisions that we made, even though there's a legal way to do it, you know? So we're pushing for that. There's a tax, it's something called a tax increment finance system, where they take money away from the general tax base to put into specific development projects. It's called the TIF program. It's supposed to help blighted neighborhoods, really low-income neighborhoods, to get some economic development and build jobs. And the union's not opposed to that, but that's not how this program has been used over the past 20 years, and it's not how it's been used under Rahm Emanuel. One thing they're funding with TIF money is a basketball stadium for DePaul University, which is a private university in a very wealthy neighborhood. We don't need to spend our tax money on that. That tax money comes directly from public schools, from public libraries, from public parks. So the union is pushing for an end to the misuse of the TIF program. We want that money to be returned to the school district. So they keep pleading poverty and saying we can't afford to make these changes, yet they're wasting money, or they're putting money where it doesn't need to go. TIF money was going to a Hyatt Hotel development in the convention center part of the city. Hyatt Hotels has plenty of money. They don't need extra tax money to raise funds to build a new hotel. So we're pushing for some of those things as well.
I can't even believe what I'm hearing, that public education money is going to these projects that have absolutely nothing to do with the children.
They do not
benefit the children whatsoever.
Right. I mean, the argument would be, well, it's economic development and people need jobs, and the union agrees with that. We do need economic development, but we need it in the neighborhoods where people live. We don't just need a few big developments downtown that could very easily be funded privately by these large companies and large organizations, private organizations. They don't need our tax support. They don't need to be subsidized by our school children, right?
No, they don't.
They don't.
That money should be going to the schools in where these kids go to school. That money should be going to, if it doesn't directly get to the child, something is wrong, and I just cannot even believe it's gone this far without legal recourse. I mean,
right.
Oh, it's just...
It's about $50 million going to the DePaul Stadium. If we took that $50 million to expand preschool in the lowest income communities, and we trained and hired people from those communities to work in the preschools,
yes,
it would be economic development, and it would be a great investment in our children's future.
Oh, yes.
So that's not what they're doing, right?
That's just...
So we're pushing for that.
We're pushing for
expanding preschool and doing it in a way that's not... Rahm has a plan to expand preschool, not as far as we would like, but he's doing it through sort of an investment banking, I forgot what they call it, but it's sort of an investment plan where we get Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and these large financial institutions to lend us the money to do it. And so we end up paying them interest on this money, and we pay them a bonus if students have higher, like, test scores in the future. It's an insane way to do education. It's just insane.
It's criminal, and it's insane, and it's an abuse of the public trust in how that money is spent. And I just wish that there was more. I wish that the community there, more parents knew, so that they could. I know that there are a lot of parents who take action in your area on several issues. Isn't that right? I mean, aren't they part of the reason why Chewy Almost won?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the networks that helped Chewy Almost pull off this historic upset were networks started of people who were opposed to excessive standardized testing. They're, you know, parent groups that started in support of the teacher strike in 2012. This is a movement that's just pushing forward. It's the movement for a $15 an hour minimum wage. So many of these issues are all coming together. We believe there is a movement, and I think, you know, what we'll be fighting for as a union when our contract is up fits very well into that movement. We're not pushing for a big pay raise or anything like that. We're not pushing for, you know, some new benefits that we don't have. We're trying to, you know, preserve a decent quality of life for our teachers, but also giving them schools where children actually can learn, where we can do our job. Teachers just want to be able to do our job.
Well, now, there's a community coalition that's been fighting to keep a Southside school. What's it called? Diet High School?
Yeah, that's right.
And this coalition's written a proposal to save their school and even done a civil disobedience at Ron Emanuel's City Hall office. Now, how is this school different from the 50 that Ron closed?
That's right. So when they did the school closings, very quickly after they announced they wanted to close 125 schools, they backpedaled a little bit and decided, well, we're going to take all the high schools off the list because of fears of student safety. In the past, when they've closed high schools without taking into account gang boundaries and things like that, there were horrible incidents of violence at some of the schools. So CPS took that off the table to try to eliminate one argument against the school closing. But even with that, they've been closing down Guyatt High School now for about 6 years. They've been trying to close it, and the community's been fighting. CPS started phasing it out, so they no longer accepted freshmen 4 years ago. And then the last class went through, and this year there are literally 12 students left in the school who refused to leave the school because that they really did not want their school closed. What's different here is that the community has banded around this school. It's on the south side in a community called Bronzeville, which in a way is like the Harlem of Chicago. Back in the day, there were many jazz musicians and artists that came through Bronzeville and came out of that neighborhood. And the school's actually named after a band leader from that neighborhood, not a band leader, but a band teacher, who taught many of those greats, who went on to fame. And the community has rallied around the school and independently wrote a proposal. It's about a 50-page proposal for making it a school that specialized in urban agriculture and green technology and global leadership. And that's what the community wanted. And they proposed that to Rahm Emanuel, and they proposed it to the Board of Education, and they were ignored. And this coalition of community groups, which includes parent groups and community organizations, did a civil disobedience. About a dozen people got arrested, including grandparents from the school. And after the civil disobedience, the school, they had a few things restored. I mean, the students were taking gym online. They had to take most of their classes online.
How do you take gym online?
I honestly have no idea, but that's what they were doing. There was no gym teacher at the school. The gym itself had been renovated through a grant that came from a contest. The students won a new gym through, I don't remember who it was, Mountain Dew or Nike or somebody sponsored this contest. And they had this beautiful new gym that was closed to them yet. And they were taking gym online because there was no gym teacher in the school. So they got a gym teacher after the civil disobedience, or at least they were promised a gym teacher. I don't think one ever really materialized. But what CPS did do, the Chicago Public Schools, is open up a request for proposals. So they said, okay, we'll agree to put a school here in this building. Anybody who's interested can apply to propose a school for this. And to their credit, they were not opening it up to charter schools, but they were opening it up to what are called contract schools, which are also privately run schools, run by an outside organization, but still under most of the rules of the Chicago Public Schools. So the community then got back together, and a bunch of us worked on the proposal to, we redid the proposal and jumped through all the hoops that CPS put out there, and we just submitted that on Monday, the day before the election. So we'll see where that goes. One other contract school did also apply, and so we'll see where that goes. It's just another sort of example of the kinds of things parents and community groups are doing to try to save schools and to try to create the kinds of schools that they really want and that our kids deserve in Chicago.
So there is a chance to save this school.
Yeah, there is. What's frustrating, though, is that now it is completely in CPS's hands. It's a very opaque process. We asked them when they're going to release the other proposal so that people, there will be public viewing of the proposals, and they haven't said there will be any. There will be a public meeting at some point as part of the process, but we don't know anything about what will actually be presented at that meeting. Generally, CPS, really hyper-controls those types of meetings, and, they really try to hide as much information as possible. So we'll see. They could turn our proposal down for no reason at all and not give us any reason. They could say the margins were the wrong size. You know, they could do whatever they want in terms of that proposal.
In terms of rejecting. And yeah. if this school can't be saved, regardless of the protests and the arrests and all of these things, does it have larger ramifications?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's just part of this bigger issue of who gets to decide. I mean, our school board is appointed by the mayor, right?
So, not elected.
Not elected, right? We are the only city in the state of Illinois which doesn't get to elect our school board. So, you know, these are people appointed by the mayor. It's completely up to them.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. It is maddening.
Yeah, so there is really very little recourse, which is why we're fighting for an elected school board. I mean, we have to fight so many different battles to try to sort of have a decent public education system here. But that's what we're doing. And if this is rejected, there will be massive protests. There will be more arrests. There will be, we have to use the tools that are available to us. You know, one of the things that Chuy Garcia did about 15 years ago was he helped organize a hunger strike for a neighborhood that wanted a high school in their neighborhood. And it was successful. They got a community school in their neighborhood, partly due to parents who were willing to go on a hunger strike for a couple of weeks. Arnie Duncan was our CEO of schools at the time, and that's one of the last things he did before leaving was he approved that school. So there are ways the community can win.
Gee, Arnie Duncan approved it. You're saying something good about Arnie Duncan.
It took a hunger strike, though.
it took a hunger strike. Yeah, that man, I don't understand, and I really like President Obama and so many things that he's done, but I just don't know why we can't get the education message out, clearly out there.
They see education as a business. They think it can be run like a business.
Test scores are
like quarterly profits, and all you have to do is increase your quarterly profits or increase your test scores, and that means your schools are good. And we know that it doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't work that way. And this generation is, you know, with all of this going, I don't know what's going to, you know, they know less than people who didn't graduate from high school back in the day.
Yeah.
Because education was so much better then in this country.
Right, and they see test scores as a valid measure. They see themselves as the test score. I mean, that's what the system is promoting, and it's awful.
It really is. Well, you write an interesting piece in the Chicago Sun-Times about social-emotional learning. And what is your school doing to teach the whole child?
So, thanks for asking about that. That's One thing I have to say is, you know, there are pockets in Chicago where schools are doing really great things.
Right.
My school is a neighborhood high school, and there are other neighborhood high schools that are doing really wonderful things, almost in spite of CPS, not necessarily because of CPS.
Right.
But, you know, one thing that we're doing, because we have a really supportive administration and an administration that understands these things, is we've put a lot of time and effort into helping children express themselves emotionally and helping teachers connect to students on an emotional level. We have a special class called Freshman Seminar where students do a lot of journal writing.
Excellent.
The journal is like a private communication between the student and the teacher. And they use certain prompts to help students, express you know, the kinds of things that they worry about, the kinds of things that can get in their way. And it's a way for us to identify what kids have suffered trauma, what kids have witnessed horrible violence, what students get into fights in the past and things like that. So we try to identify the kinds of things that lead to behavior problems and academic problems right away when they get to us. And in doing so, then we can help get them into, we have several different kind of therapeutic groups that students can be part of. We have an anger management group. We have a drug addiction counseling group. We have a trauma survivor group. And so many of our students are touched by violence and addiction and just the sort of trauma of poverty, as well as you know, literally witnessing horrible events or being abused themselves. And you know, by setting the system up where we identify it, we sort of honor the student's feelings about it, it really opens the door to a more restorative justice approach to discipline, where we're really trying to prevent the kinds of acting out that can get kids suspended or can get kids, you know, in serious trouble. And, you know, I credit my principal, my administration with that, as well as the teachers who really put this in place. And it's a program that really, you know, teachers at our school sort of just invented on their own because they saw a need for it. And we need more of that kind of work in schools and less, you know, test prep.
Less test prep and less punitive. Oh, you didn't do well on the test. Well, then your teacher's going to be gone.
Right.
All these other
right.
just really just disgusting things that are not good, and they are, you can read everything on child growth and development, and you know they're not. What you're creating there at your school is a model school that other schools in Chicago could look at then to, you know, emulate and reproduce. Because
absolutely, and that's also what, you know, the proposal for the new diet school incorporates many of these things. We had a team of about 50 people working on the proposal for the school, bringing in all of these ideas that have a good track record at other schools. Yeah. And we wanted to be a model of a community-based school that really, you know, provides what the kids and the families in that neighborhood need as an anchor in that community. And that's what we need around the city. We really do. We don't need to be closing schools. We need to be improving schools.
Yeah, we do. And at your school, you have the arts?
Well, we're very limited with that. We lost one art teacher in the last round of budget cuts. And we lost our librarian in that round of budget cuts in order to maintain the number of teachers we needed in core classes and to support the social-emotional work we're doing. So we're really in a position where if we want to have a strong social-emotional component to our school, we have to sacrifice something else.
It shouldn't be that way, of course, but...
That's right.
Where I'm going is that the arts are the container for all this social emotional stuff. That's
right.
That's a tradition, you know. That's what it serves. It's expression, you know, movement and writing, like you were talking about the journals, and singing and dancing and drawing and sculpting, these forms of expression. This is the way to deal with emotional, social emotional problems and talking.
That's absolutely true, and unfortunately it's we don't have the resources to really do that. I mean, we do some of that in the freshman seminar class where they do the journaling. They also do collages and other visual arts projects, but it's not the same as also then having a class where you're learning artistic skills and you're studying art and really building your ability to do more of that.
No,
work.
No, it isn't. It isn't. I can only hope that at some point people will say, why is it working you know, elsewhere, what is it that they do? And they go and they find out, well, they are doing what they have done for a very long time before these creeps came in. And to me, it all kind of started in the 80s, but I guess really mid-70s, where, you know, it was like the dismantling and the destruction of public education, which at that point, public education was based in all of the what we knew was best for children.
Right.
What we knew was best, you know, and now it's nothing about that. They don't care how they can take this money and give it to these chain charter schools or give it to these entrepreneurs who know nothing about education, only about how to make money, and to me there should have been a lawsuit a long time ago. It's so frustrating to me. I don't get it. And you know, we're talking about class size, and they've known since the 70s that when you go beyond 1 to 17, retention drops by 70%.
Right.
Now that's phenomenal, you know?
Right. Yet they don't even study it. Most of the studies that, I mean, a lot of times school reformers, quote-unquote reformers, say, well, the data on class size is really inconclusive. But what they're looking at is changing a class size from 30 to 28. And they say, well, that doesn't really have a big difference. Well, like, of course it doesn't, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a whole different story when you get down to the kinds of classes that they have at the school that Rahm Emanuel sends his kids to,
class of 17,
class of 18, different story.
Yeah, of course it is. And 20, you know, you can have 24 kids as long as you've got two adults in that classroom, two teachers or a teacher and an aide. And then, you know, 24 works.
Right. 24 the teachers works. Also have to have time to prepare. They have to have time to collaborate. You have, you know, there's We lost a lot of these things also when Rahm Emanuel, quote-unquote, extended the school day. What he did was extend instructional minutes for children, which took away some preparation time that teachers had.
Right.
So, which is exactly the opposite of what they do in places like Finland, where
teachers have
a huge amount of time to collaborate and prepare, and the children have more time to play and eat lunch and things like that.
Right.
So the children are more ready to learn, and the teachers are really able to give them the attention they need and give them lessons that are effective, whereas now we just get, you know, tons of paperwork and not enough time to plan, and it's the opposite of what we need to be doing.
It is the opposite, and they will tell you, those people who are teaching in Finland, that they learned it all in America. They learned it all from our universities and our teacher preparation programs. So what's up?
In the 70s. Yes.
Yeah.
They took the progressive education approach that we had in the 70s and ran with it. And they changed their system in such a positive way because of that. The other thing they do is they make sure that every student, no matter what their income level, is achieving at a high level. So they make sure they get the resources they need.
That's right.
Here we do the opposite. Students who have the lowest actual need, the kids who are easiest to educate, get the most money in general. I mean, we fund our schools primarily through property taxes. And that's something that has to change too, but that's a tough one. So in the wealthy suburbs, they spend about $24,000 per student. Here in the city, we spend about $13,000 per student, and that includes, you know, buildings and central administration. Right. So in the suburbs, where they have very little bureaucracy in central administration, and where the students have lots of support at home and come in ready to learn with big vocabularies before preschool, they spend way more than we do here, almost twice what we do here, where our students have much higher needs. And a lot of that money goes to, you know, all the testing and the oversight and the the bean counters downtown instead of into the classroom.
Yes, or
that's something that has to change.
I liked, you know, the idea that was given to me was like, if you think of public education as a great big cow, and then you milk it, you know, to get the money for the kids. Well, then you have these entrepreneurs come along, and they say, oh, look, there's money. Look at that big education cow. Let's milk it. Let's milk it and give them crappy textbooks that don't even talk about global warming. Let's milk it and give them these tests. Let's get them addicted to the tests, and we're going to make the tests mandatory, and we will just keep milking this cow, and it will never get to the students. Of course, you know, if they're our kids, they'll get there.
Right.
We'll make sure we'll give them the money, you know. I mean,
I was talking about our unelected Board of Education.
Uh-huh.
One of the members of our unelected board, who was appointed by the mayor, her children also go to the private school that the mayor's kids go to. It's a very good school, where they don't have to do testing, right? She's a venture capitalist, right? And many of her investments are in, quote-unquote, ed tech companies, many of which have contracts, multi-million dollar contracts with the school district that she's running, right?
Yeah,
so there's
huge conflict
of interest.
Yes.
That's all about exactly what you're talking about, the profit motive in education. So she has interests in companies that are contracting with our district, taking money out of the classroom for computerized test preparation and things like that. You know, and she may recuse herself from those votes, but she's still on the board of those companies and on our school board. It's a horrible conflict of interest.
Yeah. Well, are you seeing that any you can get anything done through this? I know that you're on the leadership team of Teachers for Social Justice, and that you have a strong interest in education as a force for social justice and civil and human rights, which is just what we're talking about now. Do you see this organization as, you know, making any headway in this direction?
I do. I think we are changing, and when I say we, I mean the Chicago Teachers Union, but also many groups around the country, the badass teachers, there's so many groups, the opt-out movement, that are really changing the dialogue about education. And these are issues that didn't come up 5 years ago. Honestly, people in Chicago didn't know anything about the tax increment financing scam that's going on. They didn't understand anything about how education is funded. There was no concern about the elected school board. But people thought we had an elected school board. We did a referendum in the last election. 90% of Chicagoans voted for an elected school board, in favor of an elected school board rather than an appointed one, even though, I mean, it's an advisory referendum because that has to be changed at the state level, right? So people outside of Chicago have to make that choice for us. Right, but that's an issue now that's been brought up and that everybody knows about, or many people know about, and I think that's happening across the country. I think there's backlash. You know, I don't hear too much about Michelle Rhee's Students First anymore. You know, I think they've sort of fallen by the wayside. I think, you know, there's a lot of pushback against that. There's a lot of pushback against Teach for America.
Good.
A lot of the quote-unquote sort of, you know, the magical solutions of charter schools and, you know, Teach for America and those kinds of things, I think, have been exposed now. And I think that's happening all around. So I do see that there's some reason for hope, because I think it's going to be a long fight, but I think we're going in the right direction.
Oh, that's good news. That's good news. I feel like... that's how I felt about the election, was that there was just so much of an upset that it must mean that people are waking up. It must mean that the progressives are going to, you know, finally push through and And all I can do is think about all of the children that we're losing, what a disservice we are doing. But I know that in Seattle, the teachers, they just refused to give the children the test.
That's right.
They said, you know, it's harmful. We won't do this.
That's right.
And I was so proud of them.
That's right. And parents in Seattle stood up against charter schools there, you know, the kind of chain charters that you're talking about.
That's right.
Even though Bill Gates is there with all his money pushing for it.
Right.
So there's definitely pockets of resistance, and I think through social media and through just our networks, we're starting to connect the dots.
More people are. You know, in terms of public school, where I see action happening is Seattle and Chicago, and you know I think those two spots in our nation are leading the way.
But there's pockets elsewhere too. In Los Angeles, a progressive candidate won a seat on the school board in LA, even though Mike Bloomberg spent almost $1 million to try to put his own candidate in place there. There's pockets around. There's a progressive caucus in the New York City Teachers Union modeled after the progressive caucus here in Chicago, in our union that changed our union into a social justice union, right? So there's pockets all over the place. We just have to nurture them and support them and work together.
Yes, I agree with you. Now, Philip, do you want to give contact information to the listeners?
Sure. People can email me at mr.cantor@gmail.com, and I know you always post links on your site. I'll make sure to send you links to articles and information about all the different things we've been talking about.
Yes, and you sent me some wonderful links. And I'll be posting the show on the Facebook page, on the Education Now Facebook page, and on the Google Plus Education Now page. And I will share it around on other education pages on social media. And because and if people want to comment there instead of emailing you at let's give your email again, Mr. Cantor.
mr.cantor@gmail.com.
If they can leave comments on the Facebook or Google Plus pages or on any of the other education pages where it's posted, and I'll make sure that you know someone's made a comment and they want you to reply. Well, I
absolutely
can't thank you so much for taking this time. I just feel like you're such a wonderful representative of what's right about education. We didn't really talk about your view of teaching science, which I think is an important point, and what you teach. Now, what is it that you teach at your school?
I teach biology and environmental science, and I also teach a psychology class.
Right. That's wonderful. And you were talking, in the notes, I was seeing that you have a particular view on how to teach science, that you believe that science should be inquiry-based.
Sort of the inquiry-based approach, right, where students have to a big part of what school can do to kids is squash their natural curiosity, right, by making things boring and by part of that has to do with the standardized testing, and you have to, you know, meet certain standards each year on, you know, according to the state tests and now the Common Core tests that are coming down the road, which is problematic. But, you know, wherever possible, we try to, you know, open up the opportunity for students to do their own experiments and to, you know, investigate things that they're interested in. Sometimes we've had to sort of do it as an after-school program, though, because there's not time in the classroom to do that with all the other requirements that we have. So that can be frustrating.
Right.
I think
about how important it was to go on field trips and to have hands-on experiences. And these things can only be accomplished if you have small groups.
Right. It's very difficult, yeah, to do field trips. The typical teacher at my school teaches 150 students, right? A typical high school teacher has about 150 students, like five classes of 30 students. So, yeah, it's hard to organize field trips. It means they're going to miss their other classes for the day. It's possible. Some people do it, but it's challenging. But it's definitely something that, you know, we'd like to get more into. In terms of after-school programs, we did one a while back. We got a grant to convert a diesel Mercedes-Benz to run on waste vegetable oil, sort of an environmental science, engineering, chemistry project, right? And that was awesome, but it was an after-school program. We had to write a grant to be able to do that. We actually had two different grants fund it. You know, the district doesn't support that sort of thing.
What a damper it puts on, you know, like on creativity when you have an idea, where the students in the classroom have an idea and they want to manifest it, and then they have to go through all these loops, jump through all these hoops.
Right.
It's maddening.
It is, and, you know, like I said, I think we're hopefully moving in the right direction, and, you know, if people just have to keep standing up and fighting for what's right and keep pushing, and eventually the common sense will catch up.
Yeah, eventually the common sense will catch up, and let's hope that it's just like a huge wave all of a sudden. You know, the majority just go like, aha, we will not tolerate this any longer. I'm so proud of Greece. And that's how
we'll have to reach a critical mass. And
yes,
a
critical mass.
Will happen.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, and have a wonderful rest of your spring break.
Thank you very much. Thanks for this opportunity. I always love talking to you. We have such great conversations.
Oh, we'd have a great time. You're just a wonderful person, and I have enjoyed having you on the show so much, and my listeners just really enjoy it, too. So bye-bye for now.
They should definitely reach out on Facebook or Twitter or email or whatever, and I'd love to touch base with as many as possible.
Oh, that's great, Philip. Bye now, and thank your family for sharing you with me on their holiday.
All right, yes, we're on our way to go do some fun things today. So, great, thank you so much.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye-bye.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by. And so, become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you